Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Big MX Radio Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Racetech. Check out racetech.com. Figure out where the closest location to you where they have a certified Racetech service center. That is exactly where you can get your bike serviced for both engines and suspension. And if you mention Big MX Radio, you're going to save yourself some money. Same goes with Luxon MX. Have you seen those awesome triple clamps on Club MX as well as the International Supercross team when you're probably cheering for Vince Freese? Also Luxon MX. They make amazing chassis parts and they're a mechanical engineering company that does things way over and above of what motocross asks of it. So that the owner, Billy, fantastic guy, big time motocross guy, he was like all over it and he decided to make a business directly about motocross because he wanted to give back to the industry. That's what that company is all about. They do good things and you're going to want to save some money when you mention Big MX Radio when you call up Luxon and grab a set of clamps for yourself. I am your host, Brad Gebhardt, with me on the line. We're going to talk golfing the entire time with this guy, Brock Littner. Brock, how's it going?
Oh, I'm doing good, man. Yourself?
Not doing too bad, man. This is the Big MX Golf Show. For those who aren't looking forward to that, they can turn it off right now. But no, we're just kidding. You've definitely, life after moto has taken you onto the course. I don't know if you were golfing prior to, but I think that's what we're getting to the bottom of. We're going to get to the bottom of that one way, shape, or form over the next 30, 40 minutes. But Brock Littner, for those who aren't familiar, I'll let you take the stage.
Yeah, so my name is Brock Littner. I'm now 28 years old. I used to race motocross and supercross professionally all over Canada and the U.S. I turned pro in Canada when I was 15 years old. So that was 2013 was my intermediate year racing the Pro Nationals. And that was then when I turned pro. So, yeah, since 2014 until 2022 when things took a little bit of an unexpected turn for me, that was my career of racing professional in Canada and the US. So doing supercross and everything like that.
Absolutely. And so you sustained an injury in 2022 at the Drumheller motocross facility. Was that was round two, correct?
Yeah, that was round two.
Round two. You remember the date, don't you?
Oh yeah. I got June a tattoo. 12th.
Do you? Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. It was a windy day. It was a day that sort of lives in infamy. I don't know. I wasn't there that day. Every thought I have about that race has a little bit of a cloud over it, for a number of reasons, and not just because you got hurt, but, what do you remember from that particular day? And maybe you can sort of like spin the clocks back even a little bit further, like leading up to that event. And sort of how that obviously changed the path because you sustained an injury that day that was life changing.
Yeah, I luckily for me, I actually remember everything through that day. Leading up to that day, we'll rewind to the weekend before in Kamloops for round one. It was also the WCAN. I was working full time at that time as well. Kind of stepped away from racing a little bit after COVID. And, so I was working construction and, you know, I was always just doing like local races, the BC series. And then, I went to Kamloops and did the WCAN, did the Pro National day. And I had some bike problems and I ended up going DNF. And, you know, I didn't know if I was going to make it to Drumheller or not. And I really wanted to try and do like the whole series that year. It was just, you know, trying to figure out what was going to be logical. And it was actually the Monday after the race in Kamloops, my dad calls me after work and he was like, "What are you doing this weekend?" I'm like, "I don't know, man, it's Monday." And he's like, "Well, I got the parts ordered. So you want to go to Drumheller?" And I said, "Hell yeah, I do. Of course." So we got the parts in on Thursday. We drove to Drumheller Friday afternoon. I got off work early and, then we got to Drumheller and went and checked out the track on, the amateur day that they were having there. And, you know, was a little bit, of an eye opener about what the venue was like. And, but then fast forward to the day of the race, you know, I had an amazing sleep, felt great. I again was a little shocked when we got to the track and it wasn't fully groomed for a national day, but, certain things happen and, it just wasn't able to be done properly for that, that weekend, and went out for practice. And, even though I've raced the series for however long, I still somehow got put in the B practice, after running like 6th to 8th in the weekend before.
I mean, and, come on, Brock, you were a 3-digit guy at the time.
Yeah. Well, I was always a 2-digit guy. And then after not racing, I went back to running my OG amateur number 197. And, so yeah, went out. Practice was what it was, and went out for qualifying, and I just knew I needed to be the first one out so that I could kind of get away from everyone that was in that practice and throw down a couple heaters. And yeah, it was actually on the first lap, they had this one little section where you took like a 90 degree right hand turn and you went into like a 5-pack of rollers, and a lot of us were just going like roll, double, double down the hill, and then it comes back up. And I was hitting the same line all day, and I went roll, double. And when I doubled the last one, it just sent me into a kicker, into an endo, and I nose-wheelied all the way down the hill. And, you know, I thought I was going to save it, to be honest with you. And then when I kind of knew that I was going over the bars, I was like, oh, well, this is going to hurt. And, you know, it might be a collarbone or something like that. And anyways, I came to, and, I was knocked out for 50 seconds or so. And when I came to, I thought that I was on my hands and knees trying to catch my breath, 'cause I knocked the wind out of myself. And then I just remember everyone coming over and saying like, he's not moving, he's not moving. And, yeah, one of the first people that were there was JC Seitz, obviously my mom and dad, and then I believe Steve Sims as well. And I remember seeing JC, and I knew that he knew about the quick releases on the helmets. And I was with Troy Lee Designs at the time, and we're in the SE5, and thank goodness that I was, because that helmet saved my brain a lot. And, so we got my helmet off, and then, you know, the medics got there and they're asking what hurts. And I said, my back. And so they start doing all the tests, and they're asking me like, okay, can you move your feet, and can you do this? Can you do that? And I'm like, yeah, no problem. And they're like, well, like, are you moving your feet? I was like, yeah. And I was like, are they not moving? And they're like, no. And I was like, okay, stay calm. You know, when I broke my pelvis, I kind of like lost the feeling in my legs for like 15 seconds or so. So I thought, all right, it's fine. Like, maybe I just dislocated my hips or something in that realm. So I said, well, let's get my boots off and then we'll go from there. So we got the boots off, and they said, okay, like, let's try again. So I tried again, and still nothing. And I'm laying on the ground on my back, just staring up at the sky. And I'm like, there's no bleeping way that this is happening to me right now. And I said, okay, like, let's get my gear off and then we'll try again. And we ended up getting my gear off, and they said, okay, try again. And I tried again, nothing. And I kind of like could get my head up enough to where I could see that my gear was off, and I didn't feel any of that. And, you know, usually you'd feel someone taking your gear off, and I just stared up at the sky and started crying, man, because I was like, my freaking life has completely changed. I'm paralyzed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can hear people on the radios with the medics and stuff, and they're calling stars and they're doing all this. And I'm no doctor or no nurse or anything, but I can tell when there's certain words that, you know, it somewhat means spinal cord injury. And, you know, my parents are just looking at me and they're saying, like, it's going to be okay, buddy. Just stay positive, breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. Got in the chopper, went to Calgary, had surgery. And yeah, then when I got out of surgery, I kind of already like had in my mind, like, I'm paralyzed. It's part of life. I knew the consequences of racing a dirt bike. It's not all roses, but injuries come with the sport. And I actually had like a couple nightmares in my life of this moment happening. And, you know, you wake up before you're fully paralyzed. But when the doctor says to my parents, like, I'm very sorry to say, but like, your son is a paraplegic, and just hearing my parents crying and, you know, like, they're hyperventilating, and I'm laying there looking up at the ceiling, and I'm crying too, but I just, like, I already knew. I'm like, frick, man, like, life is completely turned upside down. And ever since then, I made my motto while I was laying in that bed. I looked at my parents and I said, well, whether I'm walking or rolling, I'm still rocking and rolling, baby. So let's keep it going.
That's an outlook that very, very few would be able to muster in a situation like that. Like you said, it's kind of a worst case scenario, or as close to it as possible. You do have full range of motion and full ability of where are you? Are you complete lower body, or like you seem still pretty strong in your upper body? So.
Yeah, so I'm a T6 paraplegic. So it's about 3 inches below the nipples.
Okay.
Is where I'm paralyzed. So I do have a lot more function than some other T6 paras.
Mm-hmm.
I've found ways to kind of manipulate it and figure out what works best for me. But yeah, I do have full range of motion in my arms. Still very strong in the arms and the upper body. I just don't have any core and, obviously no legs or anything like that. So,
right.
It's been good.
Fair enough. And, this conversation actually was spawned from, me recognizing you in a commercial or one of the ads that comes across my social media on a regular basis. I'm like, that's gotta be Brock Littner right there. I recognize the flow. More than anything, like you got a good head of hair, brother. So that was kind of an easy to pick you out. But what was that all about? And maybe take us through a little bit of the searching that you'd gone through. Because I think one of the most common things that I've known from a lot of the guys that I've known that have gotten hurt is that they're kind of no stone unturned as far as options of potentially trying to improve the situation, so to speak.
Yeah, so the ad that you're talking about, it's an ad for a place down in Mexico and in Thailand. It's called Vrita Neuro, and what they do is it's a spinal cord stimulator that they implant into people that are paraplegic, quadriplegic, all that kind of stuff. So it's to help try and get that muscle movement back in the lower body that you've lost. So I knew a couple people that have gone to do this surgery. And, you know, my parents said to me when I got hurt, they're like, hey, like, if there's something that, you know, will give you a chance or maybe give you a little bit of a better life, like, we're here to support you. But as long as, like, we're not gonna tell you or force you to go do it, it's gotta be you that wants to go do it. And so when I did some research into this and I talked to the doctors that are down there and everything, I was really happy with what I heard, with what they were telling me, with some of the things I was hearing from the other individuals. And so yeah, we ended up going down to Guadalajara, Mexico, and it was an absolutely amazing facility. So many people hear Mexico and they think that, you know, it's not going to be a good hospital or anything. This hospital blows any hospital in Canada out the window.
Canada sets a low bar, but okay.
Yeah. But, I mean, even some of the states ones.
Yeah. Okay.
It was a full private hospital. Like you could basically eat off the floors of this place. Like it was so nice. Clean and so nice. All the doctors were just so amazing. But yeah, so I went down there, and what this spinal cord simulator has done for me, it was a 35-day treatment between, you know, surgery and then rehab and all that kind of stuff. So the spinal cord stimulator goes in at T12, and it also has like a little transmitter that then you have a remote in your hand. So you can turn on certain programs. So for me, I have programs for my right leg, my left leg, for my core, for my back. And then even while I was down there, I had a standing program. So neat. I could stand with the use of parallel bars. Since the surgery and the rehab and everything, I haven't done any standing on my own with the parallel bars, just because where I'm located, the physiotherapists really aren't educated enough in that realm to deal with like a spinal cord patient like myself, mm-hmm. and to do that kind of stuff. And it's also only like a 15-minute appointment where you need like an hour. Yeah. So anyways, I haven't done any standing, but since I've left there, every single day I do my leg exercises. And while I'm sitting in my chair, I can actually like my feet, my legs, I can sit and do leg raises. And what that does is it keeps a lot of muscle tone in my quads, in my hamstrings, in my calves, all that kind of stuff. So it really helps with a lot of the atrophy that you get in your legs.
Yeah.
And so just circulation and everything. So yeah, it's definitely given me a better life, and you know, helped me maintain a lot more muscle mass, and it's been amazing. So that was definitely game changing.
No doubt. No, I was curious to see sort of one of the things that you had done to sort of like the research and some of the rehab that you had taken part in order to just improve the situation as best you can. I know you're a hardworking guy, and I also know that with an injury like yours, you said you were working construction. Maybe the like is, if there was any part of silver lining of getting hurt, you don't have to work construction no more. Like,
yeah. I mean, hey, I actually liked what I was doing, because I was a heavy equipment operator.
Oh,
so I really enjoyed doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And being able to run equipment, and mm-hmm. then I also did some track building as well. So
that's
it was it was nice.
Cool. Have you had an opportunity to get into some machinery that's all hand controls and be able to do that since, or?
Yeah, I get into our skid steer every now and again out at our acreage, and go be a dirt farmer for a little bit and mess around, and mainly flatten out my track that I had out there and do some work for my dad whenever he wants some stuff done. And then I actually, the house that I'm sitting in right now, my house, I dug the footings for it. So I got in a mini excavator and dug the footings, and yeah, it was awesome. Doing the foundation was awesome. And I think my neighbor's got a little gig that he wants me to dig his foundation as well. So I got that coming up.
Oh, you're right back into it. But so after an injury like that, and maybe you obviously have a lot more experience understanding the sort of the ebbs and flows of it. But when you were sort of gaining more sort of just like you're recovering, like the injuries that you sustained, not that they're healed in any type of way, but they're like, you've sort of moved past that. Like what sort of clicked in your mind to be able to sort of like, there's some things I can't do, but there's a lot that I can do, and being able to sort of hyper focus on those and optimize those types of things. And you're currently wearing a hat that I think, PXG, that's a golfing brand, correct?
Yeah, correct.
All right, yeah. So tell me a little bit about like turning the page and finding new passions and things to go after, and then that in fact there is life after moto.
Yeah, 100%. I was a big golfer before my accident as well. You know, actually the year that I got hurt, if I wasn't going to race the rest of the Triple Crown series, I wanted to go down to Vancouver and do a lot of the little mini tour stuff. It was the Vancouver Golf Tour. I wanted to go kind of take my golf to the next level. And, you know, I started golfing when I was 13 years old. I golfed a little bit before that, but more or less just to like mess around. And then when I was 13, you know, living down in California in the winters and days off of training, I was like, I want to go golf. So I went down and I just bought a set of clubs and never took a lesson and self-taught myself. And I worked my way up to, I was as low as a 4 handicap. And for people that don't know anything about golf, that's not bad.
It's pretty good. Essentially, your average course or your average round of golf, you're four shots above par, essentially, right?
Yeah. You're anywhere from, you know, 2 to 6 over kind of thing. Like if you're a 4 in a sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, when I got hurt, golf was always a love and a passion that I had, and I needed to get back into it. It was, I love the sport too much to give it up. And, I actually started golfing out of my wheelchair, after talking to, David Bailey and, Mike Young with, Road to Recovery down in the States.
Great guys. Had them both on the podcast. Yeah.
Amazing guys. Yeah. They kind of helped me figure out what I needed to do to get golfing again. And, you know, I was cutting clubs, I was bending them until they broke and then rewelding them just so that I could get the proper lie angle. And, you know, I had a pretty good game, right in the first year. And my dad said, he's like, dude, you got to compete. Like, we got to get you to a tournament. And I'm like, yeah, like I'd love to. So anyways, I started calling around and, you know, they said, well, you need to be in a certain machine in order to golf. Like you can't be in your wheelchair. So what do I do next is figure out what machine I need to do and what I need to get, and ended up getting one. And first year, it's called a paragolfer. And if you don't know what it is, you can gladly head over to my Instagram, Brock Littner, you'll see it all on there. It's a lot of golf, but it's pretty cool. It's a machine that actually stands me up. And then I swing with one arm because I don't have any core. So then I hold onto a handle with my left to kind of stabilize myself. And, so yeah, anyways, the first year was just like a building year. And then last year was my first year competing in tournaments. And then this year coming up is going to be an even bigger year. So, yeah, it's been amazing. I got some amazing sponsors on board. PXG is a full sponsor of mine.
That's cool. That's a big brand in golf. That's like,
yeah, it was a dream come true when they said that, you know, they were covering everything, and my bag is completely decked out. I absolutely love my clubs. They're by far the best in the industry. And they're so personable. Everything with PXG is very hands-on, and they're all about precision. So it's amazing. And but yeah, going back to last year, with the golf was the first tournament round, first tournament year. And I ended up, my first tournament was a US Adaptive Open qualifier, and I ended up shooting 8 over and I qualified. And then I went to the BC All Abilities, and then we went to Rockville, Maryland to Woodmont Country Club and competed in the 4th annual US Adaptive Open. So that was awesome. The nerves and pressure definitely got to me. It was on Golf Channel, so it was on live television. It was pretty crazy, but such an amazing experience.
That's really cool. And yeah, like this shit, hats off to you for grabbing life by the horns here. And, I can safely say that I'd have to golf for quite a long time before I'm sniffing, 8 over as an able-bodied person, let alone somebody, doing so from a chair, or from
paragolfer.
The paragolfer that you play from, it's an incredible looking machine. How many times do people say, hey, no carts allowed on the greens though?
Oh man, it's so funny. Like every once in a while, I'll like put a post on Instagram and or TikTok and it'll blow up. And the amount of comments that are like, no carts on the green. And you know, half the time they're just joking around and stuff like that.
Yeah, but, it's me.
Sometimes I'll comment back and I'll be like, oh, real original. Like, couldn't have thought of anything better to say, hey?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's pretty funny. Or else, like, I'll even make jokes. Like, I'll, in a video, it'll show like carts going that way. And I'll like caption, well, I totally ignored that sign. And we're on the green. But yeah, it's a machine that's actually designed around like a greens mower and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it's all totally safe to be on there. Obviously you can't like spin around on the green. You'll tear up the grass a little bit. But I mean, think of how many people walk around the hole on a given day with spiked shoes and all that kind of stuff. Like there's much worse things than these three tires that are on the green.
Oh yeah, your golf etiquette is your machine is not doing as much damage as some of the golf etiquette that I see out there on the regular public courses. What are does it stay on golf? If we lose a listener or two like stressing on golf, so be it. I'm just curious at this point. What's a course? What's your favorite course or the coolest course you've played so far? And, how long is it until, PXG, books you a tee time at like Spyglass or something like that?
Yeah. Sorry about that. But, the coolest course that I've played so far would probably have to be, either Woodmont Country Club where the U.S. Adaptive Open was, or else there's a gorgeous course here in the Kelowna area where I live. Predator Ridge, absolute stunning course. The Ridge course was beautiful. But yeah, no, I was really hoping to be able to get down to the PXG headquarters when I was in Arizona for the Arizona Adaptive Open, but it didn't work out. And, it sucked because I was only 30 minutes away from where their main headquarters is. But hopefully within like maybe this year, the end of the year, when I head back down there, maybe we'll be able to get out with some of the people. And I mean, hey, it'd be so cool to play at like TPC Scottsdale or something like that.
Sure.
And I mean, we got the waste management this week. And so yeah, to play hole 16, that iconic par 3 or something like that, would be so cool. But yeah, like you said, Spyglass or Pebble Beach, that'd be pretty awesome too. There is a Torrey Pines Adaptive Open that I might look into doing. But I gotta see what's all involved with it. But yeah, there's actually a couple cool ones coming up on the schedule this year for the adaptive golf tournaments. It's more in the later part of the year, but I don't know if you've heard of Copperhead.
Yep.
Where they play that's where they play the Valspar.
Okay.
And you got the whole little stretch of holes where it's called the Snake's Pit.
Yeah.
Snake Pit. So yeah, like it's so crazy where adaptive golf has been able to take me. And it's just like you said, one door closes, another one opens, and you know, you pick your road and you go for it.
Fair enough. Well, I'm glad you were able to, scratch that itch and immerse yourself in a world that, yeah, you probably had no idea existed. And then come to find out that you've got some skills to pay the bills on that side of things. And just to get that passion out and to be able to compete, which I think has been such a big thing, for you in general, before and after the injury. I think that's been so I think it's good for the soul. Those who enjoy competing, being able to go out there and do that, is a really, really healthy thing. To spin the clocks back a little bit here, like, shortly after your injury, you'd spoken to like you guys like, Mike Young, maybe Donovan Mitchell, guys like that. Who was the most impactful, when speaking to you as far as like just managing expectations, being able to sort of, come to terms with things, like be more motivated, whatever it happens to be. Tell me a little bit about that process and sort of the impact that that was able to instill upon you.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like I can't really pinpoint a certain person that like really made an impact on me. There was so many people that were so supportive and, you know, so many words of encouragement, and people like Mike and like David Bailey and all of them that were just kind of, you know, there to talk, about certain things. And it wasn't so much like you're always talking about the injury. You always try and kind of like deter away from that a little bit, just because like there is so much more to life other than just being confined to a chair. And it's one of those things where a lot of people will say like you're confined to a chair, but you're not defined by the chair. And, you know, so for if there is people that are on here listening that, talk to me during those times and stuff like that, you've all made such an impact on those early times. And, you know, for myself personally, like when it comes to talking to other people in the same situation as me, I did, but then I will be honest, I kind of like went away from it, because everyone's injury and everyone's road is a little bit different. So,
right.
I just kind of, I took life by the horns and figured it out for myself. I got amazing supportive parents. My mom and dad have been by my side, you know, since day one. And, you know, can't thank them enough for everything. We've been a tight knit group since day one, and we continue to be. So it's one of those things where never going to let these four wheels stop me from doing what I love. And it's just got to keep rolling.
Plus, you just got a brand new chair, did you not?
I did. Yes, I did just get a brand new chair. So shout out to Road to Recovery and Mike Young. Thank you so much. This thing is absolutely amazing.
Fair enough. Now let's go all moto all the time for a little portion of the podcast here. Maybe a weird question for you, considering the kid is absolutely dominating after a 3-1-1-1 performance this last weekend. But if you were in a championship fight with Hayden Deegan, how would you beat him?
Man, I don't know. The dude is so good. And I was actually just watching something the other day where it was Bobby Ragan. I don't know if you watched that, where he was saying that so many people think that he is just like, sorry to say, but like this cocky asshole all the time, mm-hmm. but he actually is deep down a good kid. And okay. Funny thing is, back when he was on like 50s, I actually was at his house with like a crew of people when mm-hmm. when I was training down in California with Charles Dow and whatnot. At the Icon Gym.
At the Icon Gym, yeah.
Yeah, I was actually, we would always go over to the Deegan compound because we would rip the pump track out there. We built a pump track.
Okay.
And it was funny. Like Hayden was always like, he's always been like a pretty cocky kid, right?
It's Brian Deegan's kid. Come on.
Yeah. So like you're going to get that, but you know what? He talks the talk, but he also walks the walk. Like he backs it up. Every once in a while he gets a little bit humbled in the sense, but then he comes back out and he dominates again. So to answer your question, I have no idea what I would do. Because like the kid's got so much talent and he's got so much grit. He puts a lot of work into it. It's not like he was, so many people think that like, oh, he gets it handed to him. Like, no, like you still got to work your ass off to be winning championships, to be winning races. And you know what? The sport needs it. The sport needs to have that little bit of fire back in it. And I think it's great for the sport. It's brought a lot more, I think, people into it. And you know, it's nice to have that that attitude back.
Yeah, he's definitely injected a certain like a sense of like almost like a snarl into what it means to be a professional motocross racer, which I think there should be a piece of that. This is a gnarly sport, and you got to have ice in your veins to be able to do what they do. you could say a lot of things about Hayden Deegan, about how he carries himself or the demeanor and some of the, like the sound bites of this or that. I'll say this, this last weekend, like I find myself wanting to listen to the post-race interviews more when it's like, say like what he's going to say after a race versus, 10, 15 years ago. And I don't want to single him out, but Blake Baggett was one of the worst post-race interviews, like in all, like you just immediately rattle off the sponsors. Thank God for keeping me safe out there. We're on a Moto 2. That's an approach, maybe not a fun approach, maybe not an entertaining approach, but it was an approach. But like the kid's a bit of a lightning rod. You cannot say that he's slow. You can't say he's not fit. And when it comes to like fighting for a position, yeah, he'll send you into the cheap seats when a lot of his competitors, they don't want that type of smoke. And whether you like that racing or don't like that racing, get used to it, because he's not going anywhere until he gets until he's filled up the amount of like kind of success that he's looking to have, or finds something he wants to go do something else. Until then, the 38 is going to be in your program, whether you like it or not. Get used to it, I suppose.
No, he's he remembers what comes around goes around. So what came around to him is now going around to Levi. And
yeah,
you know, but that's like something that, again, the sport kind of did get a little bit soft for a little bit. And, you know, he's bringing that fire back where, you know, Levi might have cost him $500,000 in a championship. And, you know, he could have did the same thing to Levi.
Just
what Levi did to him. But he's like, why? All I need to do is beat him. He passed him and he checked out. And then like, yeah, his post-race interviews are so funny. Like when JT was asking him about, you know, that little bit of a heated battle and stuff. And he's like, who?
Who did I pass? Who that 48 guy is?
That was so funny. I loved it. But yeah, it was good.
Yeah. And honestly, like, yeah, from a weekend like that, like you can't take a single thing away from him. Starts were on point. Lap times fastest in every session aside from the second one, but even overall he was the fastest in qualifying, kicked everyone's ass in every race. Like, you got nothing on me this weekend, boys.
And he didn't just hole shot and take off. Like, he would get a good start, but he had to work his way up from third or fourth. And you know, then you got both PC guys to contend with, so that's not easy. You got two guys that got a, like, they got the bullseye on you at all time. They want to get you down
for sure. And we've seen a similar story like this unfold from like an amateur career transitioning into the pros. Alessi Villapoto. Alessi had his number all the entire amateur lifetime that those two raced. Like, Villapoto did not, like, he won a lot of races, but not when Mike was in that class. Same thing with Nico Izzy. And who was Nico? Oh, Nico Izzy and Trey Kennard. Like, it was always Nico Izzy and Stroop. And then all of a sudden, Trey Kennard comes in, rattles off some championships, and obviously his career ended short because of injury. But yeah, you could say the same thing about Hayden Deegan and a number of the athletes that he competed against in his exact same age bracket, that he's basically just left those guys in the dust. Like, Ryder D is having the best season that he's had as a pro yet, but he's yet to win a race, while a guy who finished second to him a lot in Hayden Deegan now has, he's a three-time SMX champ, or a two-time SMX champ, two times outdoors, one supercross champion. And yeah, he's got the life, or he's got the world to the palm of his hand as far as motocross goes. So you gotta know that he might not have had a ton of helpings of humble pie as a pro, but probably some long, quiet ride home after some Texas Nationals and Loretta Lynn's for a guy like Hayden throughout his young career, like when his youngest years, especially when, like, the thing about with Hayden is that the expectations have always been high. Your old man's a legend. Like, yeah. Whether he was, and like, And Brian was a good racer in his own right. He's better known for freestyle stuff, but the fact that his dad raced and held the national number 38 back when 125 Supercross points didn't count towards your national number, that's no slouch. That guy could ride. There comes a pressure with that, is that like, you're that guy's kid. You better be good. How good are you? Let's see how good you are. That he's had to measure up every day. There's some things he opens his mouth sometimes. I roll my eyes and shake my head. But, on a weekend like he had this last weekend, you can't take anything away from the kid was just that good.
Yeah. No, it was a great race.
450 class. And I hate to say it, but, my girlfriend Nicole mentioned it. She likes it better when Jet's not there.
You know, it makes the racing a little bit more, you don't know what's going to happen in a sense. Jet is just so good. He's so smooth, methodical. He makes racing look effortless. He makes just riding a bike look effortless. The way that he does things on a supercross track or an outdoor track is mind-boggling. The 450 class right now is unreal. I love seeing that Eli Tomac's up in the front. I love seeing that Jason Anderson is up there.
On a Suzuki.
On a Suzuki. You know, obviously Ken Roczen's still up there. But yeah, like the best thing is seeing Ken Roczen and Eli Tomac, two of the oldest guys in the class. And, you know, they're kicking ass. And I love it. You got the web wagon. I think it's going to get going here right away. You got Anderson that's riding really good.
He's getting good starts too, which is going to be a problem for, I think they touched on this in the Pulp show, is that like Anderson has like a mental list of who he will let pass him and not give him a hard time. And then he has a hard and fast list of who cannot pass him without giving them a hard time. And he's got that memory, like you mentioned. But go on.
It's nice to see that Anderson's kind of like finding his groove again, because for a couple of years there it was probably definitely hard on him. But also, like, I really like what Hunter's doing. Hunter's kind of like, this is as bad as it, as much as it sucks having your brother out and having Jet out and everything like that, you know, this is the moment where like Hunter can kind of be that guy. Where I feel like, even though he's the older brother, you know, he's always second to his brother. And, you know, he went up to the 450 class after his brother. Even though, like, when he came over, his brother didn't have, Jet didn't have a full-blown ride with Geico. It was Hunter that had that ride. And then, Jet gets the Red Bull deal, and then, you know, gets Hunter on board. So it's kind of like, now this is Hunter's time to really, to show his true riding and true grit. I love how they're two totally different riders too. Like, Jet is a get out and go right off the bat. Where I kind of wish Hunter had a little bit of that, because he is so good at the later stages of the race. But he needs, like, that first 10 minutes, he needs to be just as good as the last five.
Yeah. He's like, because, a diesel, like, engine. He takes forever to warm up.
Yeah. The last five, like 8 to 5 minutes, he's unreal. Like, he just starts clicking it off. But he just, like, and there's certain riders that are like that. Like, you look at Kenny, he is so fast right off the bat. Like, he'll throw sprint laps in like it's no man's business. But then that's also how Webb is. Webb is like a long game guy. But that's why, like, even though Webb's down, I think 21 points.
17 now, but yeah.
17. But like, don't count him out. Mm-mm. Like, it's a long series and he's done this before. He starts out slow, and by the end of the year, he could have that points lead again. What I see Eli doing now is something that, like, he's never done before, really. I mean, he's done it in the last couple of years, but then, like, injuries come up and everything. But before, if you remember, first 3 to 4 rounds, Eli was like a 6th to 9th place finisher.
Oh, yeah. 2017, he went 5-5. I tried to interview him afterwards. He walked away from me mid-conversation.
Yeah, he could not get a finish in the first few rounds. And now it's like, it's dangerous because he is an absolute animal. You watch that guy and it's insane what he can do.
Yeah.
When he flicks that light switch on, you better look out, because if you are in his way, he's coming by you and he's going to get what he wants. So that's insane. I love where he's at right now. And you know what? He looks good on the bike, and that thing's a rocket ship. Like you can see it come out of turns, and the things that he's doing, like even if he messes up a turn, some of the other dudes, they might have to like check up, even though it's a 450 class, but he's just, you're out right over top of it. And he's so good. And I'm stoked to see where the series is going to go, because yeah, it's insane racing so far.
Yeah, I'm really excited for this weekend in Phoenix, Arizona, as it's a track that, like, it's, well, like, obviously it's always a different track, but spinning the clocks back to 2017, which I believe you were in the lineup back then. We'll touch on that before I let you go here on this, but Eli went wire to wire at that race. There's a long ass rhythm section. He was going like 3-4-3 through there, and it was just, it comes easy to him. And I think the way he's riding the KTM right now, and this is not what I expected at all. I expected more of the sort of the deterioration of what is Eli Tomac to continue sort of like the, I thought that his KTM career would go similarly to how Jeremy McGrath's KTM time went. Is that like, oh, it's like you think of it as like, you almost like, be like, yeah, he never rode for KTM. We're just going to forget about that. Yeah. And he's completely flipped it on its ear. And he's like, he's got as many wins this season as he has the year, 2 years prior. And he looks like a fountain of youth over there at KTM. After 6 months ago, everyone's like, oh, has KTM completely forgotten how to win races, and they don't know how to build a bike, and they don't know how to put a team together. And yeah, like between the rejuvenation of Eli Tomac and Jorge Prado all of a sudden becoming a top 5 to 10 supercross racer out of absolute nowhere. Yeah, KTMs are looking good. It's been pretty impressive, and I'm enjoying seeing it. It might not be the favorite thing that Justin Cooper's seeing, because it's like it's all happening in front of him, but it's more for us to enjoy and watch.
Yeah, no, Glendale always is gonna bring a high speed track, long rhythm lanes, and it's gonna be fast. And you know, Tomac's gonna excel there, I think. What was it in was it San Diego? No, Anaheim 2. He wasn't, you could just tell by like watching him, he wasn't really gelling with the track. And it showed, but then, yeah, he came back in Houston and absolutely turned it around. He had that one gnarly get off, which, like they were saying on the broadcast, like it, that doesn't happen very often from Eli. And, you know, he's very lucky. And even he was laughing about it. He was like, you know, I went to drag my brake up the face and I just stomped on it too much. And, that's what happened. And, you know, he's laughing about it because he knows how lucky he got. He got through the bars there, but then to come out in that third race after taking the hit that he did and absolutely just crush it. It was so good to see. And
on a backup bike, no one's talking about that. He did that on a backup motorcycle. All these head cases, got to have the bike perfect. Jay Dungey putting together an absolute Mona Lisa of a backup motorcycle, and it goes out there and wins. That's exactly why they tech 2 bikes.
Yeah, and like for the people that don't know, like it doesn't matter if every setting is the exact same on 2 motorcycles, they feel different.
Yeah, you've had 2 bikes that are like identically prepped and not.
Yeah, you always have a practice bike and a race bike, but lots of times, like at the start of the year, you go and you ride your race bike and you hate it. Everything is set the same. Clickers are set the same. Suspension settings is the same. Everything is exactly the same, but it feels like a totally different bike. And it all just comes down to frame stiffness. And you know, it takes a long time, not a long time, but it takes time to break in a bike. And, you know, those guys got testers back at the shop and everything like that, or else like test riders that are riding that bike to break in the frames. So it's not as bad, but, yeah, like you said, it's incredible to come out, and there's so much more than just throw your leg over it and it's totally fine. Like, there's so many things you're thinking about. It's all going on in your head, and to go do that on the backup bike was incredible.
No doubt. All right. The last thing I have for you, it's the Race Tech final question, here on Big MX Radio. Brock Littner, for those who aren't already following, you need to go ahead and do so. Keep up with the guy. Certainly, because this is for sure the last, not the last time I have him on the podcast. We've been trying to get you on for a while. We finally pulled the trigger on it. And like I said, you will be a repeat offender. But last question I have for you, just please give me a Sean Hamblin story, because upon finding out that you worked with that guy, who was like, I loved looking up to him and like watching him racing as a kid. And you were working with him back in 2017 when I went to the majority of the Supercross races. You were there as well. Give me a Sean Hamblin story. Go.
Oh man, Sean, I was actually just talking to him on the phone the other day.
Perfect.
You know, Sean and I lived with Sean. There's so many stories. I don't even know where to begin.
How did that come about?
We golfed a lot. We talked a lot of golf. That was one thing with Sean, and that's what we still talk about to this day, is a lot of golf. I always say I've never gotten a golf lesson in my life, but I've had Sean. And Sean's a scratch golfer. If he does tune in to watch this, he might not be at the moment, but I know for a fact if that guy, he just hasn't been playing a whole lot when I talked to him. You know what?
Struggling with distance off the tee is what I heard.
Sean, if you are watching this, I know for a fact you'd still kick my ass. So it's all good. But okay, the one Sean Hamblin story that cracks me up all the time, San Diego Supercross, we're walking the track. Me, Sean, my dad, and my mechanic at the time, Jason Potter. And it was like a 3.53 into kind of like a 180. And then it was like a little step up. It was like a 3 backward ski ramp that then you came down into the set of whoops.
Yeah.
And it's San Diego always.
That's the whoops that was heading back towards, I guess, the third baseline. That's where Jeremy Martin went like over the, like he went like ass over tea kettle and ended up on the face of the triple going back the other way. That's that year. 2017?
No, I'm talking, maybe it was 2017. I'm not 100% sure. It might have been, but anyways,
I'm ruining stories.
This was hilarious. So I'm sitting there in San Diego, like I was saying, it always brings out then like the big boy whoops. Mm-hmm. The first couple rounds is like your intro to, you know, get back into the swing of the season. And then San Diego, they just come out with these monsters. And I'm looking at him and I'm like low-key shit in my pants. And I'm thinking of like a jump line or something like that. And Sean straight up looks at me and he says, if you don't skim these by the third lap, I'm walking out of this stadium and I'm leaving. And I'm like, oh my God, I better sack up. So anyways, first lap, I go through and I roll them. Second lap, I like come in as if I'm going to commit and then I roll them again. And third lap, I'm like thinking to myself the whole time that lap, I'm like, shit, next lap, third lap. And if I don't skim these things, like Sean's gone. And anyways, so come around that corner, hit the step up, shift up to third. And anyways, I got through the whoops, and when I got through them, I just had like, I had that sense of relief. I was like, well, Sean would be proud, and I'm proud, because them things were big.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. So that was a good Sean story. And then, yeah, there's so many good ones, man. I got the pleasure of living with him, and you know, he's someone that I think very highly of. I love the man. He's an amazing guy, and you know, super smart, and was amazing at what he did.
That's awesome. And I appreciate you sharing that with us here. My Sean Hamlin's story is a quick one. When he came back to race, I believe it was with two-wheel Kawasaki, the year he won the championship as a member of the Blackfoot Honda team, switched late that season. He actually rode Walton that year with the number one plate. But the following year, he defended his championship with two-wheel Kawasaki, and his teammate was Josh Woods. And they came to Grunthal, one of my favorite local tracks. I wasn't even racing yet at the time. And I guess whoever like brought him his gear or whatever it was, like had left the gear like on the table where he was doing an autograph signing. And I look at the gear and I'm like, can I have your jersey? And I'm like 11 or 12. And he's like, I haven't even worn it yet. And I was like, do you have anything else? He's like, no. Beat it. I'm like, all right, fine. Yeah. That's so funny. Yeah. He's like, you know, I'm like, I'm asking for gear that hasn't even been worn yet. But yeah, didn't even know. But yeah, like I always looked up to Sean. And in 05, when he had that alloy gear and the showy helmet and the monstered out Kawasaki two-stroke, like I don't think that results-wise was not a good year for Sean, but like great looking bike. Like, great look.
Sean's a good guy. He'll definitely let you know how he feels, and he might demoralize you. Or if you're another one was real quick. You know, if you weren't performing at the practice track and you were being a baby in the whoops, it'd be nothing for him to be like, okay, give me your bike. I'll go through these whoops and I'll show you how to do it with running shoes on, and that's it. No gear. Give me your helmet.
Yeah.
And you can stand on the side of the track while I show you how to do this. And I'm just standing here right now. So, yeah, it was, he's a funny guy, amazing guy. And yeah, good times.
That's awesome. Yeah. No, I've heard a few stories like that. So that's just confirming the legend of Sean Hamlin. But yeah, thanks for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate you making time for this. I definitely want to have you on again. Maybe as we get closer to the Canadian Nationals starting up and that whole situation, continuing to take form, or just reacting to the racing and shooting the shit about, all things moto. Would you accept an invitation like that?
Heck yeah, man. I've really loved being on here and chatting with you, and thank you so much. And thank you to everyone that is going to listen and all that kind of stuff. I appreciate the support, and, for supporting Big MX Radio, and let's keep it rolling.
Awesome, Brock. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Do not hang up just yet, but for podcast sake, we're going to cut things off right there.